Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
All right, guys, welcome to a new episode of Martinis and Murder. And Darren, it has been a minute since we've had a guest on the show. And now we're doubling up. We have two guests on one show. It's very
lonely, and we needed to double stuff for you today. We were just too lonely. Two was better than the price of one, of course.
I love that. We are joined today by Alexandra Cunningham and Jessica Rhodes. They are the executive producers of Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story. It's premiering June 2nd at 9/8 Central on USA. Jessica and Alexandra, we are all on Skype. We're going to try to do four people speaking all at once. Thank you guys so much for joining. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you for having us. We're really excited to be here.
We're thrilled.
Okay. Yes, exactly. I know. Now you have to be very, very specific. Yeah. But we're really excited to have you here. I know John and I have already started getting into the series, so we're really excited about this and excited to talk to you about it.
First and foremost, Jessica, where are you? And then Alexandra can tell us where you are, just so we can like visually like know where in the world we are. Because typically you guys would maybe join us in the studio at like 30 Rock, but that's obviously not happening.
And are you drinking a martini?
Good question.
Yes. Very important.
I wish I was in a studio because then I'd get to be with Alex, but we are across the city from each other. I'm in Los Angeles in Studio City at home, and I was about to pour a martini, but actually, I got to be honest, I'm home with my family. I had to get some more coffee, so I'm sipping coffee.
Fair enough. And I am in West Los Angeles. I am south of Jessica. I was actually going to have some rosé, but then I had a child crisis right before we locked onto Skype, and I did not get to have a drink. But actually need one.
I was
going to
say, maybe now's the time.
I feel like the crisis warrants it in more ways than one. But, wow, well, good to have you. John, you're still in Maryland, right?
I am still in Maryland, yes. Okay. Darren and I are both living in New York City, for those of you here on the Skype, but I came back to Maryland in March to try to escape everything, the craziness that was happening in New York City. I'm lucky that my family's here, but Darren is holding it down in New York City for us. So
that's right. Yeah. And binging all of Dirty John, essentially. So let's get into the show.
Let's get into this. Yes, we are so excited. The one question that we didn't have planned that I just wanted to ask you guys is, obviously season one, if you want to call it that, of Dirty John focused on the Los Angeles Times podcast and reporting. How do you explain this? I don't know if you're even calling it a season two. Jessica, I'll throw this to you. Are you calling it a season two? And what, I guess, similarities between the two series are connected, if anything?
Well, I'll let Alex answer, but I will say it is a season two. For us, we're excited that fans of Dirty John can return and kind of pay off the promise of they know what they're getting from Dirty John as we go into season two, which is Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story. But I think Alex can probably speak to how it fits together.
Yeah, I think that our franchise for the show is stories of love gone wrong and also of degrees of coercive control, which is something I think we're all becoming aware of now and talking about in media, which I think is great. You know, I think the show, the first season, operated on a kind of guilty escapist pleasure level, although I am kind of like Shonda Rhimes. I don't like the term guilty pleasure. It's a pleasure. I just like
don't
my pleasure.
Guilty.
I'm not guilty. Exactly.
That's right.
But I also feel like the first season we tried to speak to why people are who they are and why they do the things they do. And we tried to deal with how everybody kind of yearns to matter to someone and how that yearning can be affected and sometimes twisted by societal conditioning and interpersonal conditioning. And I think that we can all relate to wanting to be loved and to trust and to not wanting to believe that the person we love and trust has become our enemy. And I think that that's present in both seasons, although one of them was, you know, super modern and people were introduced to it through podcasting. And this story, this season of Betty Broderick, is 30 years old. I think that regardless, the two seasons have all those things in common. And that's what kind of helps them hang together.
It's interesting you say that because, I mean, now during a pandemic, I feel like people want to be loved more than anything, and a lot of relationships are changing. So for better or for worse, it's almost the perfect time for this to premiere. Now, I'm going to take this to you, Jessica. Why did you choose the Betty Broderick case in general for season two? Were you guys between a bunch of different cases? Like, walk me through your thought process there.
Well, I would love Alex to actually answer that. No, because specifically, not only is she obviously our creator and she... But it's been with her so long. Right. I will say, when she told me what season two was, I did the full body chills. There was something about it that screamed to be told through this 2020 lens more than anything I could think of. And so, yeah, go ahead, Alex.
I mean, unfortunately or fortunately for Jessica, by the time she came on board, the story was already in place. So thank God she liked it, because otherwise she would have really had to grin and bear it for many, many months. But it was a story that I remember from being a teenager when it originally happened, that I was in high school across the country in 1989. And it was a case that made international news in 1989, before Google, before the 24-hour news cycle, before TMZ, before anything.
Social media, especially.
Yeah, which kind of speaks to how it really, like, captured the zeitgeist of, you know, people's emotional attachment to relationships. And I kind of pictured Betty as one of the moms of one of my friends, because, you know, it's still in the 80s in Connecticut, divorce was kind of a gasp-worthy thing. Like, oh my God, did you hear about this? And the idea that one of my mom's friends would just, like, lose her mind and behave like that was entertaining to me, because I didn't even want to be a writer then. I just kind of thought it was amusing. And then over the years, you know, I used to reread books. I don't do that anymore, because I can just order another book on my phone immediately. But I used to reread books, and I read the Bella Stumbo book, Until the 12th of Never. She was an LA Times journalist, and she did extensive reporting. And it was the book that really captured my imagination, because I think it was the one that made the greatest effort to try to explain everyone's mindset, not just Betty, to try to put itself in the headspace of Dan and Linda and the lawyers and everyone, and, you know, to kind of depict, like, this impossible situation that everybody was in. And I reread that book over and over. And then at a certain point, I got married and had kids and drove an SUV and became upper middle class, and then realized that I had become Betty.
Minus a few things. Yeah.
I didn't murder anyone, but other than that, I could really kind of in my stomach feel what it would be like to sort of have my identity and my place in the world rocked and taken away from me. And at that point, you know, luckily I'd reached a point in my career where I could say to the studio, I'm really excited about this. Although, to be fair, we did present them with a few stories for second season, but like any smart parent, we offered them number of choices, any of which we would be happy with. Not, are you going to eat your vegetables, but are you going to eat your meat or your vegetables first? Betty was one of those choices, and they gravitated to her right away. And I was very glad for that, because it's a story that I really wanted to take a shot at telling.
Now, can you tell us what other stories could have been the second season? Or is yes. that like you're holding them for season 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and all the other seasons?
I mean, I hope so. Yeah. I hope that's what all we're right. doing. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Fingers well, then crossed. We can't get that one.
Let me ask. Okay, Jessica, hopefully you can answer this question. You know, you're definitely a part of the show. Alex is great with all these answers. I love it. But you did kind of, I think Alex touched on this, but I'm curious, how do you see Betty Broderick's story? And maybe you can even tell us a little bit more about the Betty Broderick story, but how is it relevant now compared to even in the 80s? I mean, Alex touched on that a little bit, but I actually don't personally know the full story because when I kind of wanted to go in watching the episode a little bit blind because I wasn't familiar with it before.
Right.
And frankly, as a true crime podcaster, that surprised me. I was like, oh, Dirty John, the Betty Broderick. I hadn't heard it. So what can you tell us about the story that maybe won't give away the show necessarily, and how is it relevant today?
I mean, really, when Alex started telling me about it, I thought of stories like Lorena Bobbitt. I thought of stories mm-hmm. that when they happened, the media lens around them was, oh, that crazy bleep. You know, that right. crazy woman. And I think it was both a cautionary tale for women, like, you oh. don't want to be that crazy lady. And a cautionary, it was like very much projected at men, like, these yeah. ladies are out there, beware. And that was right. really how the story was told. And I think without the, not only the multiple points of view of what made that person, quote unquote, crazy,
mm-hmm.
What makes a person crazy, people don't show, you know, like with literally, and two people yeah. participate in that process.
Exactly. Right.
And that's something really with the 2020 lens we're able to do, you know, Jordan's team did it with Bobbitt, you know, other people have done it with another, you know, lots of stories. And, mm-hmm. and for me, this one, I kind of put quotes around the word crazy because that to me is one of the things that right away I said to Alex, like that felt so contemporary. This idea that women still, people weaponize that term, like the fear you have of being called crazy. It doesn't matter where you get to in your life, your career. It's like telling someone to calm down.
Well, especially
oh my God, I hate that.
The thing that drives me nuts is when you hear someone called crazy and they're a woman, it's a very different sort of social awareness of as opposed to a man. If a man's crazy, he's acting goofy. Oh, he'll come back to his normal senses. If a woman's crazy, it's a whole different.
It's erratic.
Layer.
Yeah,
it's yeah awesome. And it's
unhinged almost.
Exactly, you know? And so that I love that you pointed that out because as a gay man myself, and Darren and I are just very aware of this stuff, and we try to bring it up as much as we can on the podcast. Sorry, it's turning into an interview with myself here, but I'm just saying, you know, that kind of stuff really irks me. And I think you hit the nail on the head with that. I hate the word crazy when it's directed towards women that way. It's a very different term, in my opinion.
Well, I was at the Variety Does a Power of Women, and Natalie Portman was a keynote speaker. I was there a couple of years, and she said this thing. She made a list of things, but one of the things she's like encouraged everyone to do was say, if a man tells you a woman is crazy, ask, what did you do to her?
Oh.
And I true. It kind of when. When Alex started telling me about the Betty Broderick story, I was like, what did he do to her?
So good. Not to interrupt you, I know you were in the middle of the thought, but I really had a visceral reaction to the crazy thing. Is there anything else you wanted to complete with that, by the way?
No, I mean, that's the thing. And I think it's still, it's not gone.
Mm-hmm.
Today,
no,
you had a visceral reaction.
Yes.
We're talking. Darren had a visceral reaction to it. We, you know, we are. And so I think that now we're just in a position, which is phenomenal, that people want to hear both sides. And I think the story that Alex tells, that the entire, you know, team built, allows you to really drop in and journey with Betty until ultimately she does some things you're not really right. with her on.
Sure.
Right. But you can certainly understand where she
I empathized with that. Definitely.
Well, that's actually what I wanted to ask, because I feel like that dichotomy is so interesting. And one of the things we've talked about on Martinis and Murder that I'm known for is sometimes I have empathy for some of these serial killers, you know, based on their circumstances or based on how they grew up. They were abused. You know, there's two sides to every story. No one's necessarily born bad. Sometimes bad things happen to that person. And maybe this is a good question for you, Alex. You know, Betty Broderick, who's played phenomenally by Amanda Peet.
I mean, oh my God, such, so good.
Such a good job of just
playing
this yeah, just like you see the inner workings of her. You know, she committed a heinous crime. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I think we can say that definitively. But she also lived in a time and a place, to your point, where, you know, she was controlled by men. So given that dichotomy, Alex, for you, like, do you want people to walk away from this maybe feeling sympathy for her? Or what are you hoping people to sort of get from this story?
Yeah, I mean, I have tremendous sympathy for Betty and what she went through right up until the moment that she let herself into Dan and Linda Broderick's house while they were sleeping. Right. That's where my sympathy ends. But yeah, I mean, when the prosecution addressed the juries in both the murder trials, because there were two of them, because the first jury was hung, they essentially put it that it doesn't matter why Betty Broderick killed these two people. It only matters that she did. Don't consider the why, only consider the what, and that the what comes from a place of irrational jealousy, hatred, and evil. And, you know, I don't believe that. I don't think you can reduce any crime down to irrational hatred, that hatred, jealousy, and rage in and of themselves are not enough to make people kill, or there'd be a lot more murderers. And also, jealousy and hatred aren't created in a vacuum. There needs to be a foundation in someone for those emotions to take root and to fester. And I think that that foundation gets laid through experiences and emotional interactions and the way you're treated by other people and what all those things do to your soul. And that I think evil is a word that we use when what we're really trying to say is that somebody's motives are a mystery. And I don't believe anyone's motives are a mystery. I think you just have to try to figure out what they are, and that if you dismiss them as a mystery, there's no chance for any of us to learn anything from what anyone does. And I don't want to live in a world like that. And that's not why I tell stories.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
I love how passionate you are about that. That's like really, it's great. No, it's like,
well, you need to be,
you need to be as you know, as a producer and as the person sort of, or as the group kind of telling this very real story. Cause it's a scripted show, but it's a real story. Yeah. And to know that, you know, the people behind the scenes are really passionate about that, I think even adds another layer to the show. Jessica, she talks about Amanda Peet and Betty Broderick. I want to talk about Dan and what do you think about her husband, who's portrayed by Christian Slater, by the way, everybody, who is
all right. Keep it in your pants, John. Keep it in your pants.
Not trying to get over worked up, you know.
John, get excited. There's a moment in an episode where he's full 80s and he's wearing these.
Keep going.
They, Alex, they were.
He's definitely wearing Wayfarers.
Yep. Wayfarers, and he's wearing this like suit jacket, this blazer, and it's we all had this very meta
I'm sure.
Business when Tom Cruise is going to do business. You know what I mean? When it's like button down polo shirt under sport coat with Wayfarers was just like, I can't believe I have done this to Slater.
Yeah,
it looked amazing. Amazing.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to see that episode. Well, how do you feel both about Dan as the person that you guys talk about in, not you guys, but you know, that you've produced in the show, and Christian Slater's performance? Because I think it's so fascinating. And I think one thing I hope listeners that are going to watch the show are picking up on, and I've only seen like the first two episodes, so, you know, like this is just early impressions, but the dynamic between Christian Slater and Amanda Peet and their, and these two torn lovers that kind of go back and forth. And even I felt a lot of my own personal situations in like their dynamic. And I was like, wow, they're really nailing this over and over and over again. It's really fascinating. What are your thoughts about Dan slash Christian Slater, who are very different people, but you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here's very different people, first of all.
Right.
I don't know that it would have worked if you also didn't understand why Betty loved Dan so much and wanted to be with him so much. So it was critical, and Christian does it in spades, that this, you see why she loves him. There's a quality about Christian. It's both in his acting, of course, but it's also who he is. There's a chemical reaction, you know, where you get that. And so I think performance-wise and casting-wise, I think Christian is such an important part of the, you know, why Betty and Amanda being exquisite, and I can't wait for people to get to see her in this role, but the Betty and Dan together, you know, I think you understand. And I think, I mean, the thing about Dan is he got to a point where he looked at Betty and he saw the man he was and the journey that took him there. Cause that's what she loved. She loved that. She was so proud of that. But Dan just wanted to be able to look at the sensational, successful man he was. And when he looked at Linda, that's who he got. That was the mirror, right? Like she just saw the man he was. And I think about that a lot, because when we talk about contemporary and we talk about why it's an important story to tell with the Betty piece, but I also think that's an important, I think that is actually a path that you have to be careful not to walk into as humans. You have to not believe your own hype.
That's a good way to put it.
To not just see your version of things. We tell the like elevator version of our story, and soon you forget all those pieces along the way. And I think it's super relatable, and I think it's a cautionary tale on Dan's behalf too. And he did a lot of really really crappy things, but I think that piece is really human, the idea of wanting to believe your best version of yourself.
I love that.
Yeah, I think that's something that probably affects all of us. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we're all looking in the mirror, hoping to see sort of the perfect reflection back.
So true.
So it's really interesting. And just kind of talking about the Wayfarer 80s Dan, you know, the music and wardrobe, it just, you guys do a fantastic job. It's so on point capturing the 80s. Even though I was born late 80s, I still know what that time period represents. But was that a major focus for you guys in the series, you know? How important was the music, especially? Because I know you guys were just trying to create the time in the wardrobe, but what was the music process like?
the most fun, it was sitting next to Alex on a couch in post and her encyclopedically rattling off.
Yes.
And then me going, yeah. And then some of our editors who are younger than us going, what?
What's this oldie song you're talking
about? Oh my God. It's like, this is all classic rock now, right?
Yeah, right.
Really good here is Howard Jones, and our editor would just be like, I'll Google it.
Oh my gosh.
So, because, you know, I might not be young, you guys, but like one of the things that was amazing about the production team was that we knew from the beginning that we were going to be covering three different decades, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, but we didn't want to, when we use chyrons, right, where it says like San Diego, 1986 or whatever, we didn't want to keep interrupting the audience's experience by, especially when we start going back and forth from the beginnings of Dan and Betty's relationship to them in the present, we didn't want to constantly be interrupting the viewing experience with dates on the screen. So, we really kind of charged our producing director, Maggie Kiley, our production designer, Jeff Massa, our DP, Ellie Smolkin, and our costume designer, Amy Stofsky. It was like, you guys all got to work together to come up with unique colorways and ratios of shooting that will convey that immediately, so that the audience can kind of be lulled into, oh, I know where we are now. We're in the 70s, we're in the 60s, we're in California, we're in Boston. And they all kind of put their heads together and they came up with this like seamless pattern for each decade, that then when they do a big, what's called a show and tell presentation to the studio and the network, and they presented it and they had a, you know, big like slides on the screen and everything. And at the end of it, the head of the studio turned to us and went, are you going to try to make Amanda Peet look like Betty Broderick? And we went, no. And they went, great. Just do all the other stuff you just said. That was
That's
the note.
Funny.
Was, do that. And so, yeah. Then the music was just basically me being like, I like Laura Branigan. So
not a bad job to have, I got to say.
That's
not
true.
Yeah, not a bad job.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Jessica, anything to add about that?
I mean, I think the thing that it's also, we talk about how amazing Amanda's performance is, and I think that we had so much fun, obviously, with the wardrobe and the fashion, and I think it's one of these other, while I think it really helps an actor get into the character, we were also making this show. There were days where Amanda would be in 10 costumes she's had, and multiple time periods, so different ways, like the work was incredible. So, I mean, amazing hair, makeup, wardrobe teams that were whirling her through this, AD's teams too, whirling her through the works and back in. But if you think about that, even behind the performance, like she just was locked in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I really wanted to do, it never made sense, but I always wanted, like, I wanted one day to just do an actual, like, time lapse.
Like, yeah,
Amanda,
yeah.
Oh my God. Yes. Back in the, just kind of rolling with it. Yeah.
Every time coming out is 10 years older, 10 years younger, 10 yeah. years older. That's so
a true
good.
Professional.
Yeah,
was.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We'll start to wrap up here. This has been a really fun, great conversation. Thank you guys again for joining us. Alex, I wanted to ask you and Jessica as well, was there anything about Betty's story that surprised you while you were making the show? You said you were very familiar with it from when you were younger. Was there something that may have popped out during production or something that surprised you in your research of her?
There was one thing that surprised me in the research, which, you know, I had a researcher who I paid to go to the San Diego courthouse with a scanning van and
oh
get the transcript. I know. I'm surprised you guys
are dedicated.
Yeah. Right. And it was 6,000 pages of transcript. I don't remember how much it cost me, but Luke went down there and he called me from the courthouse and he, you know, he's a young guy and he thought this was very funny. And he said, you're never going to believe me. I went in there and I requested these transcripts and the person said, oh, it's so weird that you would come here asking for those today. We were about to shred them. And he said this, and I actually had to lie down on the couch in my office because I didn't know that was a thing. And I guess it's because it had been 30 years that year, and so that's when they shred. I don't know, but I was just, if I hadn't had those, I don't know what I would have done. And when I was writing finale, I discovered a thing that maybe other people knew, but I never knew, and I'm pretty familiar with this story, so I feel like it's a deep cut. That the anniversary of the weekend that Betty killed Dan and Linda was the anniversary of their marriage encounter therapy when they were still married many years before. I think it was 13 years earlier. She had asked him to go to what's called marriage encounter through the Catholic Church. And it is that is featured in the third episode, that they have to write letters to each other, essentially answering a lot of questions about what does love mean to me? What do I want to be remembered for? How do I want you to see me? And that she had those books. She had Dan's book that he had written in that weekend, and she read it on a regular basis. And she took it to prison with her, which I did not know. And she was called out on the stand by the prosecutor for that, who said, you know, how often read this and think about the promises that Dan made you? And she said, well, I read it a lot. I always know where it is. I read it a lot. And the prosecutor said, so is it a coincidence that you killed them on that weekend? And I remember texting Jessica because I was like sitting at Starbucks and it was like being punched in the brain that I had never figured this out. And I texted her and I was like, I don't think anyone else knows this.
Oh my gosh.
But so... Wow. That was a very specific thing that surprised me. The other thing that surprised me just sort of in general was how right everyone was and how wrong they all were, sometimes at the exact same time, but how right everyone was in given moments to feel emotionally the way they did and how wrong they were and what they chose to do as a result. And not just Betty. I mean, Betty, Dan, Linda, friends. I mean, usually as a Libra, that's where I live, is kind of like, ooh, good point. I never thought of it that way. But in this case, it was actually incredibly painful to see how justified somebody could be in their rage or their sorrow, and then to see how destructive what they chose to do as a result became, whether they realized that in the moment or not. There are so many moments, which is a thing that we build to in the series, of if you had just taken a step back and decided to not handle it this way, it might have been a sea change in what happened. Totally. And there were so many moments like that, that it actually, it made me tremendously sad. So that surprised me too.
Those are some good surprises.
Yeah, that, I love a coincidence, or, well, maybe not a coincidence so much, but something like that.
Not.
That's pretty great. You know, was there any reason you decided not to include Betty Broderick's boyfriend, Bradley Wright, in the telling of the story?
Yeah, you know, when we started out, I actually wanted to include him, and we had him included in a lot of the pitches in the middle episodes. But the reason that I chose not to do that had a lot to do with how Betty herself talked about him and regarded him, and not to say that any of that is fair, because he was clearly a kind man who cared about her and did his best to distract her, but he didn't go to an Ivy League school. He wasn't rich. He had a fencing company. He was 6 years younger, I think, than Betty, which was horrifying to her, because she was brought up at a time where you date and marry men who are 1 to 2 years older than you, maximum 5 years older than you. That's what you do. That's what's appropriate. And being seen in public with a blue-collar guy who owned a fencing company who was 6 years younger than her, when she was used to being envied in her social circle for her handsome, successful husband who could buy and sell everyone else. She described him as so innocent that he seemed like her eight-year-old. And she told most of her friends that he was gay. So, because she didn't want anybody to think that they were having sex, I think because she thought, well, if and when Dan comes back to me, I don't want him to think that anyone else has touched me, because he will be disgusted by that. Bella Stumbo said in her book something along the lines of that Betty was and remains completely embarrassed by her lonely liaison, and that Brad would never really count to her.
Wow.
And so at the end of the day, even though, like, again, I don't mean to portray him as that person, he was clearly very kind. He tried to be there for her. He went to USC business school. He was educated. He didn't go to an Ivy League school. Who cares? But it was clear that his presence in her life did not affect any of her interactions with Dan or her thought process or decision making. All of that was kind of done in this, like, tortured vacuum of isolation. And so ultimately, that's how we chose to portray Betty, like she was alone, because unfortunately she might as well have been when it came to make these decisions. So all respect to Brad Wright, who did his best, but it didn't change the outcome.
Right.
Well, that's so interesting, because I think, you know, from what I've seen in the research, you know, I do get we get sneak peeks and episodes here at Oxygen Martinis and Murders, so everyone listening should be really jealous. But it seems like you guys have stuck very close to the facts and the source material. What are some of the other moments, maybe throughout the rest of the season or this story, Jessica, we can throw this to you, that you guys maybe took some liberties with that are a little bit adjusted for television, or maybe you really focused in on a certain aspect of a character that maybe most people wouldn't know? Is there anything else to look for in that way?
I mean, I think most of the liberties were taken in order to cover time and I mean, I'm married to a lawyer. Things take a really, really long time. Like, you know, it's at a certain point, you gotta, I think it was a little bit of consolidations and characters, I think, both to, you know, really invest in people and be able to follow the story, and also, you know, out of respect to people who actually lived through this story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say that too, that, like, when I work in the true crime space as a person who takes liberties very much, I think it's important to stick as closely to the actual events as possible, because those are what attract me in the first place, trying to excavate why people made decisions and took actions and explore those headspaces. Like last season, you know, there were some people when we were starting to work on the story of Deborah Newell and John Meehan who would say, you know, that was very strange that he chose to alienate her daughters right away. That doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe look at that. And for me, that was the reason I was doing the story in the first place, right. Was he made that choice and it clearly worked. So yeah. What was it about choosing to try to separate Deborah from her daughters that was something that a good con man would do? Because it worked. So let's talk about why it worked, why he felt like that was a vulnerability. You know, we did, like Jessica said, a lot of chronological compression because you kind of have to, especially when dealing with courtrooms and cases. We left out things that might have confused the timeline or maybe didn't contribute substantially to Betty's ultimate decision making. But, you know, we tried to represent multiple points of view and well-round the characters as much as we could. We constructed some things out of respect for the families and have some composite characters as a result of that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we're telling a story about Betty's perception of what's happening to her.
Right.
Maybe some of that stuff didn't happen exactly that way, but it's how she felt it was happening. Because right. At the end of the day, it's the narrative that she constructed for herself about what happened is the reason that she killed. And so that's what we're trying to understand by exactly. Sticking as closely as possible to what happened to her. That's what made some things about the story extraneous, because what does she think it is and why did it make her kill?
Wow. Amazing.
I mean, what an interesting story. I'm just so excited to finish Dirty John.
I know. I'm like, I can't talk anymore. I have to go watch the rest of this.
yeah, exactly.
You guys have been so great. Thank you
so
much for joining
us. We appreciate you both so much. Yes.
And,
it was awesome. Thank you, guys.
Of course. And Darren, where can people check out Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story?
USA Network. It's coming out June 2nd at 9/8 Central.
There you go. Guys, be well. Stay well. Hopefully, if you're ever in the New York area and we're all back in an office again, you can come have a martini with us, okay?
Or two.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Thanks, guys.
I'm amazed it only took one bullet to kill Dan Broderick.
The Golden Globe-nominated hit series Dirty John returns, based on the shocking true crime.
I followed the rulebook.
Betty and Dan were the perfect couple.
I have no idea how to fix this, Betts.
So how did one of them end up dead and the other convicted of murder?
I'm not the crazy one, he is.
The story that became a worldwide media sensation.
Call 911!
Starring Amanda Peet and Christian Slater. Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story, premieres June 2nd on USA Network.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.